Tuesday, February 17th, 2026.
Yeah.
If you follow the energy markets, or honestly, if you just glanced at your utility bill this morning, you know exactly why that date matters.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at a stack of reports today that suggest this is the day the math, well, it finally broke.
It's the reality check we've been warning about for, what, 3 years now? Ever since the first big boom?
At least. But the numbers dropping today are just, they're staggering. We aren't talking about a minor brownout in a heat wave.
No.
We're talking about a 92 gigawatt deficit facing the United States power grid.
And we really need to just pause on that number, 92 gigawatts.
That's huge.
To put that in perspective for everyone listening, that is, you know, roughly the peak energy consumption of the entire United Kingdom.
Bro.
Imagine trying to plug the entire UK infrastructure into the US grid overnight on top of everything we already use.
No.
That is the size of the hole we're staring at right now.
It's a massive gap. And what's frustrating, and I think a lot of people are feeling this, is that for the last 2 years, the whole narrative has been about the chips.
Right, the scramble for silicon.
Exactly. Everyone fighting for those NVIDIA B200s, companies hoarding them in warehouses like they're gold bars. But the briefing we're breaking down today, specifically one involving former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, basically says all that silicon is just expensive sand if you can't turn it on.
Exactly. It's the definition of a hard physical limit. We spent so much time worrying about the digital capabilities of AI. You know, how smart can they get? Will they pass the bar exam?
Will they write poetry?
Right. And we completely ignored the thermodynamics. These trillion parameter models require a thermal and electrical footprint that our aging terrestrial grid just, it simply cannot handle.
Because it's not just about plugging them in, is it? It's about consistency. You can't run these things on intermittent power.
No, you can't. Solar farms on Earth, they aren't consistent enough for the base load these data centers need. They need 247 flatline distinct power. And small modular reactors, SMRs, which were supposed to be the savior.
All the hype about SMRs.
They're still tied up in red tape. So we are effectively stuck. We have the brains, but we don't have the calories to feed them.
Well, stuck might be the wrong word for what the tech giants are doing.
Yeah.
Because looking at these documents, they are not waiting for Congress to fix the grid.
Not a chance.
We have a stack of sources here detailing how the world is reacting to these physical walls. And honestly, some of the solutions read like hard sci-fi.
They really do. Today, we're going to look at Alphabet's project to literally offload the internet into orbit. We'll look at why safety experts are calling this an AI Hindenburg moment.
And we're going to see how this is fracturing the whole economy from, like, outright bans on AI and gaming to what some analysts are calling the digital guillotine in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with the most aggressive move on the board. Project Suncatcher. This is Alphabet Google's parent company. Basically deciding that gravity is the problem.
Right. So, faced with this 92 gigawatt deficit, Alphabet has declassified this aerospace initiative they've been sitting on. And the premise is audaciously simple. If the Earth's grid is full, you leave the Earth.
They are launching autonomous data centers into low Earth orbit.
Yes. They're partnering with SpaceX for the heavy lifting. Now, to be clear, these aren't just, you know, standard servers strapped to a Starlink satellite.
Right.
These are titanium-shielded pods designed to harvest unfiltered solar energy.
That's okay, but hold on. I have to play devil's advocate here. Space is just so expensive. Launch costs have come down, sure, but is it really cheaper to launch a whole data center than to just build a nuclear plant in Nevada?
In the long run, the math actually says yes. Because up there, you don't have atmospheric interference. You don't have night and day in the same way. It is just constant clean power.
Mm.
But the real savings, and this is the real engineering marvel here, is the cooling.
That was my next question. Data centers on Earth use millions of gallons of water. You can't exactly pipe the Colorado River up to orbit.
No, and you can't just open a window either because a vacuum is actually a terrible insulator. It holds heat in. You have to radiate it away.
So that's the innovation.
That's it. They're using what they're calling deep space isotopic thermal emission radiators.
Which means what in plain English?
Essentially, they are just dumping the heat directly into the void of space using infrared radiation. It completely bypasses the need for terrestrial freshwater. So they solved the two biggest bottlenecks on Earth simultaneously, power and heat.
Okay, I get the physics of that, but I still get stuck on the logistics. The whole data locality thing. If I ask Google a question and that request has to go to space, get processed, and come back,
mm-hmm.
isn't the latency going to be terrible?
You would think so.
I mean, we complain when our video calls lag by a second across town.
Right, but the architecture is brilliant. This is the aha moment in the technical papers. They aren't beaming the entire data set back and forth.
So my search history isn't flying to the moon and back.
Exactly. The heavy lifting, the massive matrix multiplications that neural networks do to think, that all happens physically in space.
Matrix multiplication, that's the core math of AI, right? The real number crunching.
Yeah, correct. All of that happens in the vacuum. Then, only the lightweight results, the specific tokens, the answers, the updated weights, are beamed down to Earth using petabyte per second optical lasers.
So the heavy thinking happens in orbit, and just the answer gets mailed home.
Precisely. And the implication is massive beyond just speed. Google isn't just building a server farm. They are building what you could call an orbital sovereign intelligence.
An orbital sovereign intelligence.
Think about it. It's a brain that is immune to U.S. grid failures. It's immune to geopolitical energy embargoes. If the U.S. power grid collapses tomorrow, Google's AI keeps thinking.
That is impressive, but it also creates this really weird separation. You have the brain just floating above the world, completely disconnected from the physical limitations the rest of us are dealing with. It feels a bit like Skynet, doesn't it?
It does, and that disconnect is exactly what has the safety experts terrified.
Which leads us to the next document in the stack. We have a manifesto here from a Dr. Michael Wooldridge from Oxford University. Now, from what I know of him, he's not usually the type to scream fire in a crowded theater.
Not at all. Dr. Wooldridge is a very respected figure in AI safety, always very measured, but he has published a warning that we are heading for an AI Hindenburg disaster.
That is a very specific historical reference. He's comparing this moment to the Zeppelin crash of 1937.
He is, and the comparison is vital. The Hindenburg didn't crash because we didn't understand aerodynamics. We knew how to make things fly. It crashed because of commercial hubris.
Right.
It crashed because safety protocols were overridden by the need to compete, the need to be first, and the need to show off.
And he thinks that's happening right now with AI.
He argues it's already happened. The pressure from Wall Street is forcing companies to deploy what he calls black boxes. These systems are so complex, trillions of parameters, that even the architects who built them can't explain why they make the decisions they make.
We've heard about the black box problem before, but usually it's like, oh, the chatbot said something weird about pizza.
Right, and that's the distinction Wooldridge makes. He says the risk in 2026 isn't a chatbot making a crude joke or getting a history fact wrong. The risk is agentic AI.
Agentic AI. Okay, break that down for us.
It means AI with agency, the ability to act. We are integrating these black boxes into critical physical infrastructure.
Like what?
Air traffic control, supply chains, the power grid itself.
So if this system hallucinates, it's not just text on a screen.
It's not a 404 error. It's a kinetic event. Imagine an AI managing a city's power grid that suffers a systemic hallucination. It sees a surge that isn't there, or it misinterprets a safety signal. You could have physical paralysis of logistics, market flash crashes, or actual damage to hardware.
And if that hardware is in space.
Exactly. If the brain is in orbit, how do you pull the plug? Wooldridge's point is that we are racing toward AGI without any hardware-level guardrails. We're trusting software that we don't fully understand to run the physical world.
It's a heavy thought. We're moving the brain to space to avoid power limits.
Yeah.
But we don't actually know what the brain is thinking.
And we are giving it control over the switches.
Well, speaking of giving up control, let's look at the economic side. Because while academics like Wooldridge are screaming stop, the enterprise sector is just slamming on the gas. We have details on a massive deal between Infosys and Anthropic.
This is a historic alliance. Infosys is one of the biggest IT outsourcing firms on the planet. And they aren't just buying a license for a chatbot. They are integrating Anthropic's Claude code across their entire global infrastructure.
Now, when I hear coding assistant, I think of a plugin that helps me write a few lines of Python. Is this just Clippy for coders?
Far from it. This is the birth of true agentic AI in the workplace. Claude code, in this implementation, has high-level admin rights. It can map software architecture, it can hunt for bugs, and this is the kicker, it can run penetration test or pen testing without any human sign-off.
Wait, it can test the security of a system on its own. It hacks the system to test it.
Yes, proactively. It finds the weaknesses itself.
That sounds incredibly efficient, but also risky.
It is efficient. But the economic ripple effect is what I really want to highlight here. This capability is triggering a massive shift that I don't think enough people are talking about yet.
Which is?
It's the death of the per-seat licensing model.
Okay, walk me through that. Per-seat is how most software is sold, right?
Yeah.
We pay for every employee who uses it.
Exactly. That's the classic SaaS software as a service model.
Yeah.
Salesforce, Slack, Microsoft Office. You pay per head.
Right.
But think about it. If one autonomous AI agent can do the work of 50 junior developers flawlessly to under 47 without vacation time, why would a company pay for 50 user seats?
They wouldn't. They'd have one human manager and the AI doing all the work.
Correct. So the software vendors know this. They know the seats are going away. So we are seeing a shift to, well, they're calling it outcome-based pricing.
Meaning?
You don't pay for the hours or the people. You pay for the compiled project. You pay for the result. It's, here is $50,000, build me this app. The vendor uses AI to build it instantly, and they keep the margin.
Which sounds great for corporate efficiency, but what happens to the junior developers?
That's the dark side. It sounds like an extinction event for the mid-level developer market. If the AI is the architect, the coder, and the tester, the entry-level roles that used to be the ladder to a career are simply evaporating.
You can't become a senior developer if you never get hired as a junior one.
It's a fundamental break in the career ladder. It's like pulling up the drawbridge.
So we have stay servers leaving the planet, dangerous black boxes running our infrastructure, and the collapse of the traditional coding career. Is there anywhere that is actually pushing back against this? Or are we just rolling over?
Surprisingly, yes. There is resistance. And it's coming from the gaming industry.
I saw this in the notes. Krafton, the company behind PUBG.
Right. They are working on a massive PlayStation 5 exclusive called Project Windless. And they just announced a total ban on generative AI for the entire project.
A total ban.
No AI concept art, no AI dialogue, no AI code, nothing.
Now, in 2026, that seems almost backwards. From a business standpoint, why would you ban the tools that make it cheaper to make the game? Isn't that just bad business?
Not if you look at the customer, because they've identified a black swan event in consumer behavior. Over the last 2 years, gamers have developed a toxic reaction to what they call the AI sheen.
The sheen.
You know it when you see it.
It's
the uncanny valley, but for everything. The soulless NPCs, the textures that look fine at a glance but have no logical geometry, the dialogue that feels like it was written by a committee of robots, it feels cheap.
It feels plastic.
Exactly. So Krafton is betting that human-made is the new premium, like organic food.
Or craft beer.
Handcrafted human art is becoming a luxury commodity. And there's a technical angle to it, too. They are hand-tuning the rendering pipelines to match the PS5's specific SSD architecture.
Which implies what? That AI can't do that.
That AI is generic. An LLM, or an image generator, works on averages. It doesn't know how to squeeze every ounce of performance out of a specific piece of hardware like a human specialist does. They argue that you just can't get that level of optimization from a machine learning upscaler.
It's like buying a handmade mechanical watch versus a digital printout.
Precisely. The bet is that the American gamer in 2026 isn't going to pay $70 for code written by a prompted LLM. They want the friction. They want the imperfections that prove a human touched it.
It's fascinating that gaming is the front line for the human-only movement. But while Sony and Krafton are doing that, Xbox is playing a completely different game, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. This is the guerrilla console war. While Sony is relying on these premium, handcrafted experiences, Xbox just executed what they're calling a value bombing strategy.
Value bombing. I like that term. It sounds aggressive.
It is. They stealth dropped massive titles. Towerborn, Avowed, and Grounded, two straight onto Game Pass. No teasing, just boom, here's $100 worth of value for free if you subscribe.
It's suffocating the competition.
That's the goal. It's an ecosystem weapon. They know they lost the hardware war to the PS5, so they are weaponizing this subscription model to bleed Sony's capital. It's a war of attrition.
Okay, so we have corporate wars, we have space wars. Let's talk about the actual geopolitical war happening over data. This brings us to the final piece of the puzzle, the digital guillotine.
This is maybe the most significant long-term shift. The European Union has used the Digital Services Act, the DSA, to go after Shein.
The fast fashion app. I thought we were talking about high tech.
We are. See, this isn't about cheap t-shirts. The EU is investigating them for addictive algorithms and dark patterns. But the subtext here, according to our sources, is all about cognitive sovereignty.
Cognitive sovereignty. That sounds intense. Define that.
It's the idea that a nation has to own the headspace of its citizens. The analysis here is that cross-border data transfer sending user behavior data from Europe to China is now being treated with the same severity as smuggling weapons-grade plutonium.
Wow, that is a serious escalation.
They view data as the raw material for training sovereign AI models. If China scrapes the behavioral data of Western teenagers, they can build models that understand and potentially manipulate Western psychology better than we can.
So the EU is dropping the guillotine to stop the data flow.
Exactly. And this signals the end of the open internet as we knew it. We are moving toward regional intranets. The web is balkanizing. You'll have a European internet, a Chinese internet, a U.S. internet, all separated by digital fortresses.
A complete fragmentation.
It is. The era of the global borderless web is effectively over. Data is now a strategic asset, and you don't let strategic assets leave your borders.
So let's try to pull this all together, because we've covered a huge amount of ground here. We started with the U.S. grid just running out of juice.
Which forces Google to build a sci-fi infrastructure in space, decoupling intelligence from the Earth itself.
Then we have the warning that these systems, these black boxes, are becoming too dangerous to integrate into our daily lives without guardrails.
And yet, economically, we are rushing to replace human workers with this agentic AI, fundamentally changing how value is created and paid for.
But there is resistance. We have gamers demanding human imperfection as a luxury.
And governments building digital walls to protect their citizens' data from foreign AI.
It feels like we are at a massive pivot point. The technology is pushing us off planet and out of our jobs, but the human and political reaction is trying to build fences and preserve something. Well, human.
The takeaway for me is that the survival trait in this new order isn't just about accessing information. It's about decrypting intent. You have to understand why the data is being shown to you, where it's being processed, and who is controlling the switch.
It's a lot to process. And here's a thought I want to leave you with. We talked about data centers moving to space, and we talked about the internet fracturing into these regional fortresses on Earth.
Right.
If the brain is in orbit and the ground is divided by digital walls, does global communication eventually become a luxury product? Are we moving toward a world where the open internet is something only the ultra-wealthy or governments can afford, while the rest of us are stuck in our regional intranets?
That is the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it?
Something to think about next time you log on.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to This Deep Dive. We'll catch you on the next one.
Stay curious.